Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Ruth Ann Jones, and on behalf of the University Library Colloquia Series, I'd like to welcome you all to the first lecture for 1999. Our speaker today, Susie McKee Charnas, is someone I'm very pleased and honored to have here at MSU because her work combines two areas that are, as a few of you know, very dear to my heart, and those are feminist studies and science fiction, fields that I think have a great deal to say to each other. They have in common a desire to imagine how the world might be different. Sometimes how the world might be better as an encouragement to us to keep working for change. Sometimes how the world might be very much worse as a warning to us that a great deal more work needs to be done. Susie Charnas is one of those pioneers whose work brings together these two worlds which have a great deal to give to each other. In the course of a 30-year writing career, one of her signal achievements has been a series of novels. Walk to the End of the World, published in 1974, Mother Lines, published in 1978, The Furies, published in 1994, and a forthcoming novel, Conqueror's Child, all of which unflinchingly examine the survival of women in a very bleak future world. The first three books were honored several years ago with the James L. Tiptree Award for Best Exploration of Gender Issues in Science Fiction. Some of you might be thinking it's rather curious to have an award for writing about gender issues named after a man. Actually, James Tiptree was a woman, Alice Sheldon, who found when she began writing in the early 60s that it was a great deal easier to get her stories published in science fiction magazines using a male pseudonym than her own name. The world of science fiction has changed a great deal since then, and our speaker today is one of the women who created that change. Please welcome Susie McKee Charnas.
Thank you. I am nearing 60, but I'm not sure I'm a pioneer. I see myself with grooves in my face. You have to understand, I come from New Mexico, and Jack Williamson lives in New Mexico. He's a guy who's been writing science fiction forever. I think he's nearly 90 now, and he's still writing. And he's a real pioneer. He remembers his parents and a covered wagon and things like that. I mean, he's been around a while. So I'm just a sort of latecomer, actually, to the field. And is there a light on this? I bet there is. Ha, ha. Technology shall not win, not this time.
I shall win.
It's taken as kind of axiomatic that science fiction was a boys-only adventure literature for a very long time. And in fact, it pretty much was until in the 60s and late 60s and the 60-70 break, a lot of women writers broke into this field. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the field in general, the genre of science fiction, and what's happened to it, and what the experience of being in it at that time of change has been like. But first, a question. Let me put it this way. In New Mexico, at the University of New Mexico, up the hill from where I live, there is a class in creative writing that is taught every year by somebody who starts off the class in creative writing by saying, you may write anything you like in this class, but no science fiction. Science fiction is commercial, it's cheap. We're not writing that. We're writing high art or nothing. And I've often thought about this condemnation of the genre in which I work and for which I have a great deal of respect to the nether levels of literary hell in terms of what the hell is going on here. And I think people often say, well, it's because it started as a kind of, it started as a in America, in this century, okay? Let's assuming that it didn't start with Bellamy and it didn't start with Shelley and it didn't start with Cyrano de Bergerac. It started in this country, more or less in Popular Mechanics magazine in the 30s. And it was for guys. It was for guys working at their workbench in their garage. That's who was reading this stuff. And it was coming out of the tradition of the American inventor, the unrecognized, unsung, plain guy who came up with the wonderful invention. It was kind of Thomas Edison sort of thing. And that was the tradition that it was speaking to, more than the high and mighty tradition of let's make moral perfection in the future. And so it started out being for young fellas who were following their daddies in the workshop and wanted to get their hands on those tools. And it got the whole human part of it, the story of the person's personal life, the inventor's personal life, was never given much, it was given a short shrift, because that was not what they were interested in. They were interested in great inventions. And then, of course, World War II brought us the fruit of great inventions in many ways, and that just reinforced the technological push of science fiction. But things have changed a lot since then. And when I hear people still saying this kind of thing, science fiction is junk, it's low-level, crass trash, and you shouldn't read it and you shouldn't write it, I'm thinking a couple of things. Number one, I'm thinking people who make their living working with high culture, what we think of as high culture, are feeling very much under threat these days because the boundaries are dissolving, because the popular media of all kinds have encroached, because the larger population has no interest in high art and is going to the movies and watching TV and reading romance novels. Well, this was always true, but now we seem to worry about it more. And I'm not really sure why. I guess we worry about it more because we have a mass market economy. And if you only appeal to a small stratum of the society, of the culture, you're not going to be able to make enough money to make a huge, enormous profit bigger than the world. And so why bother? Whereas, if you publish a piece of cheap garbage of some style or other that sells billions and billions of copies, you're going to make several very large planets worth of money. And that's what you're supposed to do because that's what your investors want to see. And you are now not a little publisher, you are one arm of an enormous conglomerate, and the guys who are calling you to account are accountants, and they're used to seeing the profit margins of General Motors, not of some little publishing house somewhere. But they bought you because they thought they could make a lot of money out of you, so they'd better make a lot of money out of you. So this mass pressure puts a lot of people involved in the high art end of things on the defensive in a way I don't think they have been before. And so you get this essentially snobbery about science fiction and also about the other genres of fiction as well. In addition, you get a lot of comments along the lines of, well, science fiction is junk. I never read it, of course, but it's garbage. Now, there's a little problem here. small problem. I never read it, but it's garbage. And that means that the teacher I'm talking about, who says no science fiction in my class, is also saying, I've never read any, so I don't know how to judge it. And if you write it for me, how am I going to mark it? Because I won't know if it's any good or not. I won't know if you stole the whole story from Amazing Magazine, an issue in 1957, because I've never read any. I won't know if it's original. I won't know if it's well done. I won't know if it's up to standard. I won't know anything. So I'm not going to let you write it. Because that way I keep my edge, and you have to do what I say anyhow. So that's that. Furthermore, if I am in the academy, and I'm in an English department or a literature department, and I decide I'm going to teach science fiction, it's possible that my colleagues will not respect me. It's possible that I will find myself marginalized in the academy. It's possible that I don't want to take the chance of being marginalized. I would rather make myself a nice, sound, comfortable career teaching something more mainstream that everybody respects. Now, I never realized this until I went to the yearly conference of, I don't know how to describe these folks. I love them dearly, but what are they? The International Conference on the Fantastic in the Arts. There is also a conference of popular culture, people who do popular culture studies. And I don't know much about those folks, but I do know that the Conference on the Fantastic was established because people in English departments had no place they could present their papers if their papers were about science fiction or about fantasy. If you wrote a book about Tolkien, you were not welcome with your paper at the MLA. So these folks said, well, we'll set up our own little conference where we can come in Florida in the middle of winter, well, no, in March, actually, and revel in our delight in the fantastic and the sciences. And so I began to understand that the folks that I like, who I go and see there almost every year, are, to their departments, often marginalized teachers, because they're not teaching the core, the mainstream, the canon, the well-recognized classics of high art. Finally, in this area, I think I have a feeling that this culture in general the mainstream culture, really doesn't like the idea of people being helped to think in alternatives. There's only one way to do everything here, and that is, look how prosperous we are. Capitalism is the only answer, and we better not think about any other arrangement. Family values are the only answer. I mean, there's a bedrock of conservatism here that I think is basically very, very frightened of the thought that there may be people out there reading books which say, well, what if families were made up of, what if there were three sexes and one of them was, and they go off in some very odd direction that you're not even supposed to think about. You're not supposed to, because it won't help you sell insurance. So there's a kind of a set against this, where science fiction once was completely in tune. It was in tune with society. Society said, invent, patent, make a million. And science fiction talked to that. It said, a smart guy can solve any problem. And then, of course, once he's solved it, he's got the gadget, and he can become a rich man. Now science fiction is saying things like, what if men could have children? And people are going, I don't want to hear about that. Family values. No, no, no. The family is breaking down. Everything's falling apart, and it's all your fault for thinking about things like that. So the culture is basically not friendly to a science fiction that is really less technological now than it was, and more sociological, more about values and less about techniques for doing things, less about hard edge solving problems and making bucks out of that. Well, at the same time, we're looking at a situation where somebody clones a sheep. You remember Dolly? It's not very long ago. Somebody clones a sheep in England. All of a sudden, all over the magazines, articles, what are the ethical implications of cloning? And all of us in science fiction looked at each other and go, we've been talking, we've been writing books about this for 30 years, exploring the ethical implications of cloning. And you would think no one had ever mentioned the word before. Clone. What is it? What does it mean? It was like being in trapped in a cage full of morons. It was unbelievable to watch this popular explosion of like this brand new thing that nobody's ever considered. Well, yes, a lot of people have been considering this for quite a long time. A lot of very bright people. And so how come nobody even noticed that this was happening? And I just made a little list last night, I was thinking about this, of themes that science fiction has covered over the past, 30, 40 years. I tend to think in 30-year blobs, because 30 years is how long I've been doing this. It actually goes back further. Overpopulation, a famous book called Stand on Zanzibar by John Brunner is a good example. It goes way back, it's like late 50s. Environmental pollution. A recent example, Stan Robinson's very fine story, Venice Drowned, in which people are taking, Venice is underwater because the water level has risen because of global warming, and they do tours underwater with scuba gear to look at Venice. This is a wonderful story. Mass bioextinction and animal rights, lots of stories about that. Epidemic diseases and social breakdown. Go back to 1948, An Earth Abides by George Stewart, a classic and still a fine book on this subject, where society collapses because of an epidemic. Multinational takeovers in the computer world, that's cyberpunk. That's the whole field right there. Nuclear, chemical, biological, and psychic warfare. Everything from Jerry Pournelle on down and up. Race, hatred, and genocide. The domestication of drugs. The barbarization of the poor. The bunkering of the rich. Genetic engineering, bionic medicine. The impact of longevity. Cultural extinction. All kinds of imperialism, new forms of art, that's Samuel Delaney's, Chip Delaney's field, among others. The war between the sexes, well, we know about that. The disappearance of work, except for a privileged few. Anybody notice that happening? In this country, I'm talking about locally. Media dominance, and of course, the end of the world. Any old end of the world, there are many to choose from in science fiction. Meantime, what has mainstream fiction been doing? Well, there's Jennifer's career in high fashion and her tooth and nail climb to the top of the fashion house and what it has cost her psychologically. And there's Bill's nervous breakdown and or his career as a serial killer. There are also some very good books, very many of them about looking back at one's childhood, the suicide of one's brother turned into fiction. a bad home situation and abuse by a bad father recalled and turned into fiction. But consideration of large issues, not much that I can think of. You probably can think of more, because you probably have all been reading a lot more widely than I have in general fiction. But my impression from what I've seen is that a lot of it is trivial or extremely personal, close and psychological, carefully ignoring the space between myself, person, individual, and the great spiritual questions, which is society, economic arrangements, social arrangements, how we live with each other. Not a lot of that. Joan Didion has done some work in that area with people traveling. But the mainstream is not read the way it used to be, partly because it's not out there where our future is. It's in our past. And a lot of us are, it gets kind of repetitious after a while. Well, let me go back a little bit and talk about how science fiction got where it is, which is in that middle space between the individual and the great spiritual questions, although in fact a good deal of science fiction now moves out into the spiritual areas, as those of you who've read, say, The Sparrow or Gene Wolfe's books will know. These are things about their mystical, even Childhood's End, Arthur Clarke's book of what, 1952, 53, is about the end of the world and we all become a mass being. We reach our apotheosis, kind of Teilhard de Chardin in fiction. So this is an old theme. But let me go back a bit. About the time I started reading science fiction, which was, 40s, 50s, the field was not very, it had not broken out into the many areas that it is in now. It was mostly future histories, like Asimov's Foundation series. The more modern version of that is Dune, Frank Herbert's Dune series that went on forever and ever and ever. And this was all coming from a kind of sprouted from the brow of Olaf Stapleton, who was better than any of them. But that, he goes back a long, long way. Then there was barbaric fantasy barbarism. The world has broken down into little feudal fiefs, and the mighty hero gets to ride around like Mad Max and push people around and save the good and kill the bad. And these little nerdy guys with thick glasses are reading this stuff and saying, yeah, paste them good. No more electricity. No more civilized frills. Let's just get on with a battle axe. And these scrawny little science fiction nerds thought this was wonderful stuff. This was the warriors, the pirates, and the mighty thews. You know the mighty thews? Conan had mighty thews. And there was a great discussion as to whether these were muscles here or muscles here. But anyway, they were mighty. And occasionally there would be a female warrior, and she would become a sort of right-hand girl to Conan or whoever he was. Or there would be a wicked witch queen who was trying to dominate and destroy boys, I mean men. Or there would be pretty much that, tavern wenches, many tavern wenches. Wench, bring me another thing of brew. They couldn't say stein of beer, so they had to say glob of brew. They invented things to say, so you would think you were somewhere else and not imitating bad medieval stuff. This got a kind of, it was a kind of past barbarism and a future barbarism. But it was all about, we don't have to deal with the telephone anymore. We can just hit each other with maces, and it feels much better. And the strong will rule, and everybody else will be good to them. Otherwise, they'll get their head knocked off. And that's the way it should be, because I can get my head around that. Telephone's tougher. That's how old this is. Telephone. In the 50s, we got Tolkien. And Tolkien wrote a book, books I hope everybody has read. Has everybody read The Lord of the Rings? I hope. If not, you really should. I mean, they're not new anymore, but these are really important books for the fantasy field. This was civilized fantasy. Not barbaric fantasy, very civilized high fantasy. Extremely conservative, but in a tasteful way. You are what you're born to be. And the women are all extremely graceful and have tinkling musical voices. And somebody cooks really well, but I don't know who, because you never see any work being done. But they all have feasts, really good feasts. And somebody cleans up, but you never see that happening. and they ride their horses very hard to their great battles, but nobody ever stops and waters the horse, or takes the saddle off, or rubs the horse down, or rests the horse. I mean, these were in the mind. But then Tolkien was a philologist. He was much more interested in the languages he was creating, and in the rhythm and the gestural size of real saga type national epics and poetry, that kind of thing. That is what he was looking back at, and Anglo-Saxon story poems. So this then became, it became role-playing games, actually, what it became. It became a field full of imitators, most of them really awful, like Terry Brooks, and some of them not so bad, like Guy Gavriel Kay. And it became what turned into the fantasy role-playing world, where you could be a wizard while you were eating your potato chips. And you could be a mighty warrior, or you could be a dragon with six heads, or one of these things for a game's worth, and then you could pick up the game again next week. Do it some more. So that was the kind of the fantasy end of things, and then I was reading lots of near-time space exploration books like Arthur Clarke's books. These were about hard science, and these were the books that got dated, like The Deep Range about farming the sea, or Prelude to Space about launching the first shot to the moon from Australia, because that was a good place to do it from, so there it was. And these were, and kind of techno puzzles like Hal Clement's books, Mission of Gravity. These were very hard science books, because science was simpler. It was still a little bit more like garage invention science, and people could keep up with it, and they didn't feel lost in it, and they could kind of enjoy it. And then there was lots of Cold War fiction on the beach. Lots of invasions of horrible monsters who were really communists in monster suits were coming to take over everything that belonged to us. And it was all kind of big issues and big wars and big men taking care of big stuff. And there were a few women in it. They went in and they programmed the auto cooker in the kitchen when somebody needed something to eat. And they reloaded the blaster in the middle of the fight. And some of them were even scientists, like Asimov's Susan Calvin. Note the name. It's not by accident that she's a frigid female scientist. All the female scientists are frigid until the hero kisses them, and then all of a sudden, that changes. And that was kind of the, this was still stuff being written by boys for boys to read, all right? And there were a few women who were writing with usually using male names, pseudonyms, so that they could get published, and boy readers wouldn't just say, oh, I'm not going to read that story, it's by a girl. So there was C.L. Moore, and there was Andre Norton, and there were several other folks who were also writing under ambiguous names at best. Well, by the time we got to the 60s, when I was 20s, it was my 20s, things had gotten pretty stale, and these stories were just circulating and recirculating. And I think science fiction would have just croaked right there. It would have dried up and died out. Except that there was this thing called the New Wave. The New Wave was a couple of guys like Bob Silverberg and Harlan Ellison who said, wait a minute, I can write a science fiction story that's in stream of consciousness. I can import all kinds of gadgetry from the mainstream that will tone up this stuff and make it get taken seriously. And they wrote some pretty good books and stories. They did a pretty good job. And the main thing that happened to women in New Wave fiction was they stopped being frigid and they started being sexpots. Because sex was one of the things that they did in the New Wave that was new, because science fiction had hardly had any up until then. So this was a real new, exciting thing. Sex! Wow! Babes! Holy moly! And it kind of helped to keep things alive for a while. And then the impact of things like, well, let's see, Star Trek started to be felt. Because Star Trek on TV didn't last very long, but it had a tremendous impact. And the impact was that it came into everybody's living room. So lots of women got to see it. They didn't have to go to the store and pick up something that was on the shelf of science fiction where only boys went. But here came this stuff right into your house, right? And in it, there was a woman on the bridge. She was a secretary, but she was on the bridge of a starship. And there was Mr. Spock. And they all fell in love with Mr. Spock. And women started reading science fiction who hadn't started before. A lot of younger women actually got into this and said, hey, you know? And women who had been reading it secretly, because you had to identify with the boy hero in order to be able to get through the story and you didn't want to admit that you were doing that, started to say, yeah, I'm reading science fiction. And this readership began to build. And it was this readership that responded to what happened in the late 60s and early 70s when women started to write this stuff. Of course, Marion Zimmer Bradley had already been writing for a while. When did she publish this? Shattered Chain, I wonder. I've got that down here somewhere. 1986, but she'd been writing for quite a while. And she also brought a lot of people into the field, a lot of readers. And you have to understand that in the science fiction field, readers become writers. Most of the writers have been fans in their lifetime. They've gone to conventions, they've read SF for years and years, and they've always known that if you just wrote a good enough story, you could publish and you could be like Bob Silverberg. And you could go into the bar and drink, have a drink with Harlan Ellison, and because you meet at the conventions, and there's a lot of free flow back and forth between the readers and the writers, and the editors and the agents. They all get together at the conventions. It's not a closed off world, writers and readers. So when Ursula Le Guin published Left Hand of Darkness in 1969, there was a readership there. And there were women who looked at this book, including myself, and said, a woman wrote this. And it's about gender, actually. How many people here have read Left Hand of Darkness? That's good. It's a book about a race of people who have been bioengineered in the past, and they now run along on neutral until they hit a period when they become sexually active and they either become female or male, depending on who they're with, and then they go back to being neuter again. And at every mating period, they take one of the roles or the other. So it's not really hermaphroditic. I've heard it described that way. It's much more complicated than that. But what it means is that everybody gets to be everything. And this was an absolutely mind-bending idea for science fiction, which had just gotten used to the idea of sex, for God's sake. We just did that. And all of a sudden, we're talking about trading roles and assuming different sexual identities. It was hair-raising for a lot of people. But for women, it was very exciting to suddenly have somebody writing about something that actually dealt with human relations instead of human-machine relations or machine-machine relations. And a whole lot of this stuff just blossomed. It had been waiting to happen. And the success of Left Hand, I think, pretty much allowed it to happen. I mean, Left Hand of Darkness won, I believe, both the Nebula and the Hugo in its year of publication, and has been recognized in the mainstream as a serious book ever since. So people said, wow, if I could write a crossover book like that. And so we all jumped in on this. And we, as people like Joanna Russ and Vonda McIntyre, and Naomi Mitchison had been doing this for years. She just died a couple of weeks ago at, 101 or something? Old lady. And James Tiptree Jr., who'd been assumed to be a man for many years, in fact, was assumed to be a man until 1977 when Harlan Ellison blew her cover by mistake. And people said, what? Because up until then, they'd been saying, see, a man can write intelligent, sensitive material about the genders, the sexes. Look at James Tiptree Jr. He was the only example, and he was a woman! So it was a bit of a scandal when Harlan blew that, and nobody knows why. Well, whether it was... He says he didn't do it on purpose. He says it was a mistake. And he's probably right. Harlan's not a bad guy. So what difference did it make to have women come into this field? What was different? Well, it went like this. Instead of, oh, let me go back a little bit. When guys wrote about women in science fiction, what they tended to write was something like Virgin Planet by Paul Anderson, which is about a sort of hive society of women. And somehow or other, it was always a hive society of women. It was always organized like an anthill. And some guy or a group of guys would suddenly show up in the middle of this, and my God, there was always the scene where they would teach a woman how to kiss. And suddenly she would go, oh, I need a man. And the whole society would fall because it was an unnatural hive society. And people were not meant to live this way. And it was invariably technologically backward, imaginatively backward, no arc, no forward impulse of any kind, because it was assumed that women just go round and round in the same track. You know, I mean, they don't do anything original, they just have children, or not. So when women came into the field, you started getting kind of interesting things like Marge Percy wrote a book called Woman on the Edge of Time, in which she posits a utopian future, small scale, in which men have been engineered to be able to produce milk. They can lactate. And so they can nurse children. And so the whole parenting thing has changed. It's all different. And some kind of parity has been established between the sexes. Joanna Russ wrote about single women on their own leading expeditions of exploration. That had never happened before in science fiction, ever. This was in the 70s. About women adventurers, time travelers, rescuing girls from sex slavery in horrible, ghastly futures. And of course, The Female Man, about essentially reverse societies where women are dominators and exploiters of men. And that had not been written about either, except as horrible examples to be overthrown by the doughty hero and his friends who appear and teach the heroine how to kiss. This was a little different different approach. Jessica Salmonson wrote about women samurai fighting off demons. And in fact, it turns out there were women samurai in history. Not very many, but there were. There were some. And James Tiptree Jr., Ali Sheldon, wrote several famous stories. She wrote a story called Houston, Houston, Do You Read? How many folks here know this story? Not enough. Houston, Houston, Do You Read? Is a story about some astronauts who return to the Earth after a long delay and discover that women have taken over the whole place. Oh, this is working too. Women have taken over the whole place, and the gist of the story is that the women kind of look these guys over and decide they don't need them. And essentially send them off to be kept somewhere until they die, because they're disruptive and they are not needed. They've worked out reproduction on some other basis. And so the great heroes come home, make a mess of it, and are turned away. This was a new idea at the time. So was the idea of women flying kind of messy organic spaceships with plants in them and cats and stuff, you know, held together with string and kind of messy looking, instead of sleek silver phallic ships. That was a Tiptree. Tiptree started that and Russ did some of that too. And Tiptree did some stories like Love is the Plan is Death, which were extremely dark explorations of sexuality as destructive force for everybody concerned, which was something that really had not been touched much by other folks. And folks like Ursula and Chip Delaney and John Varley were writing stories about body swapping, about sex changing. Varley wrote a series of stories set in a world where you could change your sex at will. You just went and had a little operation thing and you became somebody else with a different sex. He didn't do as much with this as you would do with it now, but he did broach the subject, which was unusual. Well, I kind of checked into this scene in 1974 with a book called Walk to the End of the World. And it was a pretty radical book for its time. It was a dystopian book about sexism pushed as far as it could go, which went to more or less genocide, cannibalism, and lots of other nasty things, men against women. And I was kind of, you know, I thought you write a book and you're sort of, you publish it and you never hear anything again and you go back to your garret and you write some more. And lo and behold, I was introduced to the world of science fiction conventions, which I had not known about. Anybody here ever attended a science fiction convention? A few, good, okay. Correct me if I make a mess of this. My editor, who was a woman named Judy Lindell Ray at Ballantine Books, suggested that I go to the World Science Fiction Convention in Kansas City in 1976. We came into the hotel as the Shriners were leaving, and we came into the hotel with the people I had never seen before either, the people with the furry leggings on who were playing Conan in the hall. These are called hall costumes. The people with the belly dancing costumes at 2 a.m., jing, 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 jing. And the Shriners are sitting, one of them actually, I saw him kick somebody off the stairs because we were sitting on the stairs being rude, and these guys in red fezzes were not happy with us because we were practically aliens ourselves, I think, to them. But for me, I mean, and there were 4,000 people, there were 4,000 fans there. That's a lot of people for a little hotel in Kansas City. In Boston, a few years later, it was 7,000. It's been over 7,000 ever since, pretty much. So I walked into this, and it was agents, editors, writers, critics, and they were all invited there by the fans, by the readers. The readers set these things up. The publishers do not. The readers do. And they run them, and they send invitations out, and they ask you to come, on your own expense, be on the panels, and they'll sometimes you get a free membership. But what you get is you get to talk to your readers, and they get to talk to you. And they say things like, I haven't read anything of yours, but will you sign my program? And they say things like, someday I'm going to write a real critical paper on you. And they say things like, I've written a novel in 3 parts. It's about 12,000 pages. Would you read it? And they say things like, I really loved your work. Or, I really loved your work, except this thing that you did here, I wouldn't have done that. And you begin to get some sense of who's reading your work, what they're getting out of it, what's working, what's not working, and what you know, what you're aiming at here. And you see that your fans tend to be quite young, although not as young as they used to be. There's an aging in the field that people are worrying about right now. But there's this tremendous activity, and the whole writer in the garret thing just vanishes because they're doing a masquerade. I saw one masquerade at which somebody appeared as a fawn on stilts, so that he had an animal leg. His leg was shaped like an animal leg, and he had and little horns, and it was gorgeous. It was like, I couldn't believe it. And some of these things are splendid. Panels on everything. The book dealers all come. You can get books you can't get anywhere else. You can get books you wouldn't want to get anywhere else, but there they all are. There's an auction of all kinds of stuff that's donated, a lot of it by the writers. There's a banquet. There are prizes given, recognition, mass autographings, and lots of parties where you all stand in little tiny hotel rooms sweating and yell at each other over the noise. And the people who want to smoke go out on the balcony. But it was the thing that was exciting about it was not so much all the people and not so much all the activity about this genre that I had been told wasn't really worth anything, but the fact that there were so many new women writers there and women readers who were coming out of the closet and coming to the conventions because they knew the women writers were there. And they wanted to say, thank you so much for writing this book or that book. At last, a book with women in it that looked like real human beings. And there was this tremendous amount of feedback going on that was very exciting. And it gave rise to fanzines, which are amateur publications put out by the fans, some of them for women, like there was one out of Madison, and one out of Canada by Amanda Bankier. Can't remember the name of it now. But they were all about issues that women were facing in science fiction and publishing, and they were extremely useful. And there were there was something called a room of one's own, which was the idea of, I believe, a Canadian academic named Susan Wood, who died much too young, who said, we need a programming space just for women. No men allowed, where women writers and women readers can get together and talk. Well, the men went nuts. They could not stand the idea. We actually had people break into the room because they couldn't stand the idea of women talking to each other. The fanboys got very upset about this. First of all, they didn't like it that women were coming into the field. It was spoiling everything. Adventure is when you get away from your mother. If you are with your mommy and your sister, you cannot have adventures, right? So you don't want them around in your fictional world. And you don't want them in the extension of your fictional world, which is your fan world. So there was a lot of resistance, there was a lot of fuss, and in fact, eventually there was a good deal of backlash in the genre. There's always been a kind of an undercurrent of anti-feminist science fiction stuff going on. And there were some pretty interesting examples of it. I'll just mention John Norman's books about a planet called Gore, where women are all slaves and enjoy it. And Richard Adams' Horse Clans books, which are sort of rough nomad warfare and taking women as prizes. But mostly they were things like, and they were very pointed books that were clearly anti-women, like John Boyd's book called The Pollinators of Eden, which is a book about a frigid woman scientist who's cured of her frigidity by being raped by a giant orchid from another planet. There was a good deal of that, you know. Force them, they really like it, that kind of thing. And that was the anybody see a movie called Zardoz? Long ago, it's an old picture now. That was a pretty good example of the kind of thing. A woman-dominated society, and a rough, barbarian guy walks into it, and all of a sudden they realize that what they have isn't worth anything. They'd much rather have Sean Connery. Well, I mean, that's a hard argument to... I can't really argue with that too much, but you can see he's still the sexiest man alive. The guy's unbelievable. But it was there was a fair amount of that sort of thing. At the same time, the many women who had come out in fandom as science fiction readers and enthusiasts supported the heavy growth of the kind of soft sciences and talking animal fantasy. There was a lot of kind of fairy tale fantasy that was written for women readers and by women readers and became very popular. And a lot of people now complain that science fiction has been swamped by the fantasy end of the spectrum, which is wizards and sorcerers and dragons and stuff, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, I hear myself. And it was, a lot of it is very romantic, very traditional. She gets the boy in the end, that kind of thing. Not real exciting, but very lucrative for some people. Well, the Science Fiction Encyclopedia, a very large book out of England in 1979, has a listing for New Wave, and it has a listing for sex, which is all about how men write about sex. And it has no listing for feminism at all, which gives you an idea of the kind of resistance there was to this idea that there could be a feminist stream in the river of science fiction, and that it could be important enough to write an article about. They would mention it when they wrote an article about Joanna Russ. They'd say she wrote feminist science fiction. But somehow, there wasn't enough of a reality and a weight to this to have an article of its own. And a lot of the boy fans started complaining that nothing was going on, science fiction got boring, and then along came Gibson and cyberpunk, and everybody felt much better, because it's mostly boys. In a, I'm thinking of Neuromancer, and well, there's some other things, Bruce Sterling's books, that tend to be very, very heavy techie, near future techie, downbeat, noirish kind of worlds, the struggles of the underdog. It's kind of Raymond Chandler in the future, that sort of thing. The feel of it is Blade Runner, that movie. But of course, women have moved into this too. Pat Cadigan has, Melissa Scott has a new book out called Night Sky Mine, and I think there's one, a new one coming, which is about, in cyberspace, women in, just moving around in cyberspace, same as anybody else. And there's not a confrontational edge to these. It's just assumed that women are out there. Not only that, but I've got to say, I'm not a big Melissa Scott fan, but I got to tell you, I was reading, it was either Trouble in Her Friends or Night Sky Mine, and it suddenly became apparent that everybody in the story, except one or two people labeled BLAN, Blans, was a person of color. Because that's who most of the people in the world are. And out in space, that's who most of the people in the world are. And the whites are a very small minority. And it's remarkable when you see one on a space station. And I thought, oh boy, we're finally getting somewhere in the neighborhood of putting reality and the future together, instead of having one of these old-fashioned stories where everybody's white, everybody's male, everybody talks techno-speak. And they're either young and heroic, or they're demonized or angelicized patriarchs. And that was the old model. That model disappeared. I don't think we have that anymore. So what's changed in recent years for us writing science fiction as female people is, first of all, the recognition. One of the things that happened is, remember all those, that kind of barrierless flow of people in fandom at the conventions? Some of those fans became editors. They're women and they're editors, and they buy books by women. Before that, most of the editors had been men, and that change alone accounted for some of the efflorescence of women's writing in science fiction. And we had, there is a convention, at least one convention in the country, that is a feminist science fiction convention, and that's WISCON in Madison every May now, which is organized by a group of women fans out of the university down there. And they put an emphasis on gender issues in science fiction, but that's not all they deal with at all. But that's one of the things that they do deal with. You'll notice that mainstream conventions generally don't. They used to have a stream called Women's Programming. They don't even do that anymore. They'll have one panel. That's backlash. It's a few other things too, but it's certainly backlash. The Tiptree Award didn't hurt. the establishment of an award in the name of James Tiptree Jr. after she had died by some women writers who got together and said, you know, we really need an award that's named for a woman. They're all named for men. The Hugo, the John W. Campbell, the, what's the other one? There's another, Clark, the A.C. Clark Award. I mean, there aren't any. So they said, let's have a Tiptree Award. And people who know will know that this was a woman. And that has been a focus. This was an award that was established by Pat Murphy standing up and making a speech and saying, I think we ought to have this award. And everybody came rushing forward and said, I'll do it, I'll do it. And they started doing bake sales. And they were raising money selling cookies to each other. And now they're giving out $1,000 a year to, you know, pick a writer and they'll give an award with money. I don't think there is another. Is there another award that gives money? I don't think there is. It's the only one. Because people are so, women are so willing to support quality writing about real issues between men and women, and others, I guess, that the money flows in. People give donations. There's an auction. People just spend money like water. It's unbelievable. I've sat in these auctions and watched people. They're bidding as if it was a dance. You know, the arms go up, and it's $300, and it's $500. And these are not people with a lot of money. I don't know where the hell the money's coming from, but it's unbelievable. It's astounding. It's a kind of a performance art piece each time they have an auction. And then they end up with all this money. And because of that little nexus around the Tiptree, there are several feminist science fiction lists on the internet where we all talk to each other now. We had to wait for conventions before, or APAs, which were associations of people writing letters to each other. Now we talk all the time. All the time. Yak, 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 yak. It's unbelievable. Sometimes kind of boring, sometimes really great. And then, so I mean, we all keep in touch with each other now. And finally, we get things like, maybe some of you here noticed that last year, I believe, year before last, a MacArthur Award was given to Octavia Butler, who is a science fiction writer of considerable repute. She lives in Los Angeles. She just bought herself a house for the first time because she got all this money from the MacArthur Grants, and it was for science fiction about gender and race and species and so on. And that was an unusual piece of recognition for us. People, of course, have been saying for years, who are these people who give the MacArthur Awards only to white men, mostly? Because if you look at their award list, they're pretty heavily weighted. And I think some of the criticism got through, so they said, well, here's a chance to do two things at once, because Octavia's black. So they did a woman and who was a black woman, but who's a very fine writer and a very interesting thinker. I recommend her latest book, which is The Parable of the Talents. Not easy, but very interesting. So there's been a considerable amount of change. My theory about all this is that science fiction was ready to croak. It was thinning out to nothing because it had exhausted the little piece of human experience that it was willing to explore, and that was male techno or male fantasy, but without sex, male fantasy, without sex, boy fantasy. And as with many scholarly fields, at about that time, what happened was that when women came in and said, let's open the rest of the field of human experience, this was an infusion of energy that reinvigorated the whole field. And I think I saw that happening in some scholarship fields. The whole deconstruction stuff where you start looking at the motives of writers in literature and looking at gender as one of those components, as well as class and lots of other things, I think was very strong. Lifter of scholastic, of academic effort that had been kind of languishing, kind of puttering along, doing nothing much. And I think a lot of fields got a tremendous infusion of energy from women coming in as participants in the 60s. And science fiction was not an exception to this. Well, most of our taboos are gone now in the field. The whole culture is suffused with science fiction. If you look at television, 4 out of 5 programs on in an evening are fantasy or science fiction in one form or another. I mean, somebody's a vampire, somebody is a witch, somebody has supernatural powers, somebody's being sent back into the past from the future, somebody's going into the future from the past. It's just all over the place. And we're beginning to wonder, oh, there is one taboo left, I've got to remind you. Chip Delaney will always say, there is one taboo left, and that's childhood sexuality, or rather adult-to-child sexuality. And that, I think, still is pretty much a taboo. It's always treated as abuse, which it almost always is, but that's my feeling about it. It's not Chip's. But we have this problem of, what do we write about now? Because we're sort of catching up to ourselves here. I came on a plane and I opened the American Airlines magazine, and there's an article on the Ice Hotel. The Ice Hotel is a hotel made out of ice in Sweden that this guy builds every year, new, with a new plan, out of 300,000 tons of ice blocks. And people come and they stay in the ice hotel and they sleep on blocks of ice with reindeer pelts over them. And they drink their drinks out of glasses made out of blocks of ice. And the whole thing is completely nutsy, and it's like right out of science fiction, okay? It's right out of science fiction. At the same time, there's an article about a new resort called Atlantis, where they've reconstructed the supposedly the ruins of Atlantis, and it's underwater. And yeah, and there's going to be a resort at the Cleopatra's palace that's been discovered off the coast of off the coast of, who saw that TV documentary? Off the coast of someplace over there. And a bunch of French archaeologists discovered it and decided they're going to bring everything out, clean it up, take pictures, and put it back. And the Egyptian government is going to build tunnels so you can go down under the water of the bay and look at the remains of Cleopatra's palace. Now, in 1950, C.L. Moore wrote a book called Judgment Night with the Pleasure Planet. There were a lot of pleasure planets in science fiction in those days. Well, we've got them. Las Vegas is the pleasure planet. Disneyland is the pleasure planet. Drugs and all, even if it's not supposed to be there. So, and that's not the only place where this is happening. We've really caught up with ourselves in a lot of ways. And a lot of science fiction writers solve this by writing about war in the future. Because you can always posit a war up there and then play with war technology. But otherwise, it's kind of hard. We're having a tough time seeing ahead. I'm going to stop, because look what time it is. Anyway, that's kind of where we are. And I think the next infusion of energy has to come from somewhere else. It's probably already happening, and I don't know about it. And you probably don't know about it yet either, but it'll come. It'll come. I think we're ready for the next wave of something. But we guys are not through yet. We're not through yet. We've still got some things to do. And it's been a lot of fun. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you. Do you have any questions? We have about 4 minutes, do we? As much time as we want. Oh, that's nice. Thank you all. Any questions? I'll answer if I can.
Yeah. Where do you draw the line between fantasy and science fiction?
Ooh, not that question. Nobody knows. There is an argument that all literature is fantasy, right? Mm-hmm. You make it up. There's an argument that if it's got elves in it, it's fantasy. There's an argument that if it could ever be real, it's science fiction, but who knows what could ever be real? That's no argument. I think that means if, judging from the science that we know now, we think it ever could be real. But people make jumps all the time. Faster than light drive is a fantasy, so far. It's a fantasy, but it's part of science fiction. Much more so than the elves are. And it's a fantasy element. So I don't draw the line. I mean, I know there are things that I consider science fiction. Kelly of Displace is science fiction by a gummy god. There's no question about it. But it was elements of it were fantasy. Kind of thing. Things that hadn't been discovered yet. And so I don't know. I don't know where to draw that line. I have a hard time with it. If there's a talking dragon or an elf, I'm liable to think that it's fantasy. And I'm also liable not to read it. Yeah.
I think
almost all fiction is a form of fantasy. I agree with you, and I would extend it further than that. But most people want more definition than that. I mean, that's much too broad to be useful for me. And I don't know how to draw that distinction. It's really hard, yeah.
Americans mostly hear about the science fiction in English. And I don't know, you know, spit about what the French or the Germans or anybody else were doing, but I wonder if you did. Is the progression the same? Is it different?
I can't really tell you that. I can tell you that science fiction is not popular on the continent as it is here, as popular. You know, it's popular here is questionable in terms of numbers. But I know that there's a very strong British tradition. There's a rather weak French tradition which keeps tossing up really good books, like Planet of the Apes, which was a book by an honest God writer, and it was a damn good book. And right now they've got a new one out. Oh, it just came out. It's about... they're having fights about it in Paris right now as we speak.
If I could remember, I'd tell you, but I can't. No, I really don't know what's happened with most of it, because the only stuff that's accessible to me is in English. And there are big problems with it. You know, if it comes from a so-called third world or developing country, it tends to get labeled magical realism anyway. So even if it's science fiction, you'll never know.
Well, there's land.
Who?
Stanislaw Lem.
Yes, Stanislaw Lem. That's the only name I can think of. You're right, but he's translated. That's how come you and I both know.
Yeah, exactly.
That. Yeah. And he's a Polish, he's been working in Poland for a long time, and writes very interesting stuff, very intellectual. Yeah.
I was curious, earlier in your lecture, you mentioned that sci-fi fans are aging and there's not enough younger fans. I was curious what your thesis or your theory is about why that's happening.
I have a theory. Right, you spotted my theory. It's glowing right over here. It burns, a little ember. And it goes like this. The people who would be the new generation of science fiction fans are all playing computer games. They're not reading books. They're reading comics, if they read at all. And they're playing computer games, and they're going to read this. It's the whole visual thing has displaced print for young people. And it's very hard to get kids to stay with a book, because a picture is so much faster and simpler and easier to grasp. That's my theory. It may not be true. I could be wrong. No, not sure not. Yeah, I could be wrong, but that is what I think is happening. And there's a good deal of concern in the publishing world about whether we're going to be able to maintain science fiction as a viable genre. Because when you go to conventions, there's a lot of gray hair. Too much gray hair. And I think it's the languishing of print as the pastime of choice for you. Next to this. That too is one issue, yes.
Nobody else?
Yes.
And related to the video game question, what do you think of people, script writers for interactive movies? Do you think they explore social issues or just shoot the bad guys?
Not so far, they haven't explored much. I think it tends to be really lowest common denominator, but I think eventually an art form will evolve in some of this. But it's still very clear. In the way that science fiction was very cool when it was all about science and guys and garages and stuff like that. So I think it's too soon to say. These things happen so fast now that you can't keep up with it. And I think that's going to mutate into something interesting. But at the moment, it's pretty superficial. Bang, bang, pow, jump over it, bang. Not a lot of social dimension to this. Lots of young male aggression outlet, and that's pretty much it. And some imagination, not enough. Not enough. Books is better. Well, my prejudices are showing. My age is showing. Books are better. Oh, well, I really think it's true. What else? Speak. It's your last chance. What am I bid? That's it. Looks like that's the end. Thank you all.
Yeah, I can't spell that well.
Oh,
I'm Laura's daughter.
The cream color, the second edition is on the, this is the title of the covers, it is white on the old one and cream on the. Who was this writing for Science Fiction for 1993? Yeah, who's this? Oh, Jane, yes, yeah.
I have a little list here.
The problem with out of German is that you went know, with just being I mean, Germans look at science fiction
for
as anti-intellectual claptrap, no matter how much they may have contributed to it.
I mean, when I was in Germany, you don't know what, I mean, you go into a book store and you say science fiction, and they give you this look like you were the lowest creature ever to crawl out of a pile, and they point you to a section of bookshelves that is about that big as the space between those windows. And you look, and every one of those authors, you know, because they've been translated from English. I looked for native German-speaking science fiction authors. I found one tiny little volume from Austria. Nothing. Lily Lay is dead, and nobody cares.
Yeah. Hi.
And Chip Flanders was asking me if he loved science, if you can believe it. I know.
And Maureen was here, and Maureen isn't in there.
Yes. Maureen Christie isn't in here either.
No. Yes. Wonderful.
Oh, yeah, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Nice to see you.
Enjoy. It's
no,
Dan, the people in the class also were signed on silently, most of them, to the. Not the Wisconsin feminist, but I had to drop that. It's so busy. But I remember a couple of times there were big bursts of things about media, like G.I. Jane and so on. They're just going crazy.
That was funny.
It was interesting to watch.
It's a good list. There's a lot of good shoulders on it.
On the other hand, one of the writers, this is Tony, is a scriptwriter for one of the most successful science fiction shows. Straczynski, who actually recommended them. This is nice.
Crossover the other.
I know.
Especially since it's from Battle on 5, which is easily the best guy.
That's where the young fans, while they're watching that.
And there are issues being raised.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really funny. I was reading in a textbook for a mainstream course about how, you know, there's this new thing about interactive fiction, and there's this website that you'd go to, and you could, you know, after you read one block of text, then you would go on, and maybe you'd go to one block of text, and maybe depending on what you've been before, you'd go to another block of text, and they're talking about how this was so wonderful and new, as if, you know, we hadn't been reading about it since, every little tiny piece of crud story talks about how, well, we didn't have books anymore, you know, we just had little monitors on which, you know, it was either direct nerve induction or whatever.
Jesus, exciting. Just like Dolly the Sheep. I could not believe that. What, we have not thought about the ethical implications of cloning. Well, yeah, we have. You haven't.
Yeah, that's because we haven't been reading any science fiction ever.
Ever.
I have a story about that joke.
Okay.
What, incidentally, was as a Clarion graduate. Must be.
Clarion.
2 years. You're before last. How did he?
Congratulations.
Yes,
you
survived. 2 years.
Yes, I actually survived.
You survived the creative writing program.
I'm surviving that too.
This is not easy.
No, it's not.
This is a mind.
We turned.
Yet hope is high as we continue toward the etc.
At one point, when you said a few words at the beginning, I did turn around and spoke, and I did lock eyes and not knowing it to one another.
Yes. Yes.
Oh yes.
In this class, you.
Oh yes. Well, yeah, I was a bit surprised because what you started out about the people who are opposed to science fiction. I moved in. I've been in the conservative circles. I moved in the academic circles, and I've moved in the SF circles. And I mean, I've met a few people in the conservative Christian circles. Science fiction is not a good thing. But really, the more people I've met are in the more liberal academic circles who are, I mean, mm-hmm. I get more Marxist objections to science fiction because that's, you know, it's not realistic. You're talking about a world of infinite resources. We'll never get the revolution and with people like you.
Spend your time on that.
Yeah.
I actually had that question raised. I was doing a talk at a library in Lincoln, Nebraska or someplace, and a guy came and he stood up, ancient man. How can you waste your time on all of this imaginative stuff when there are people still hungry in the world? And he'll ask me what I answered, and I can't tell you because I don't remember. I blanked. I was so horrified. And somebody said later, he said, oh, lovely. And he asks the same question of every speaker who comes to town.
Well, I mean,
it was an interesting experience.
Jerry Pournelle was writing about the answer to that objection back in the 1970s, and what called a step farther out.
My word. It's, you know, if you don't see it, you're not going to hear it.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's kind of a waste of time.
And for the crazy guy with the end is near sign.
Yeah, it's a lot like that. Or the end is not near enough. Right. Why are you wasting my time?
I mean, it's scary how many people don't realize what, you know, we've gotten already. I mean, I was telling a friend of mine who's she's got cerebral palsy. I said, well, you know, you've got your wheelchair. Where do you think
it came from? That's right.
You know, it's the space you're sitting in. The
you're
space
sitting
program.
In the space
right now.
Exactly.
And she said, I never thought of that.
Well,
nobody else has.
Well, it's hard for people to think that. And people who haven't had any kind of experience thinking that way are very threatened by it.
I think folks in liberal arts and humanities side of liberal arts are also into fear of science.
That's right.
Not everyone has it, but it's kind of. I get similar responses to a course on literature and medicine that I teach. Why would you want to take that? You know, some of you could just take it. But most of us focus like pretty good, naturally, journalism, comm arts, and you know, two or three English majors out of 25 or 30.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's just not for me, you know. It must be boring.
It must be boring.
There's medicine.
It works the other way.
It's the compartments will be the death of us.
Yeah.
The truth. Well, it's because we're so big, we can't function without compartmentalizing. We don't know how to do that yet. So we do it. And it's very preparatory letters to people.
Sooner or later, I suppose evolution will take care of it.
Either that,
it's good
or not.
Or it's like that. So either it'll get out of work, we'll get out of
that. That's right.
We're testing all the time. The very long haul.
It's coming in the same place anyway.
Actually,
you know, in the long run, we'll all be dead, so who cares? So, yes.
Sister, are you telling me about the time machine?
a remake of The Time Machine?
No, I was telling you that there was a talk on.
Oh, it's
okay.
On The Time Machine. On The Time Machine. Who's talking about?
I think it's actually a Robin Briggs for the incoming freshman.
Oh, that's
right. It signed on a common novel. Last year it was a Carl Gerassi novel. I moderated that last year, and so I had to read the book.
He was there last year, wasn't
he? He was there last year.
This time you get to read
it. I had to read it.
Are you at the phone as well? Because that's what the graphic office is. So
oh,
I'm writing.
Terry Pratchett.
Oh, yes.
The clock on the clock in Dent's house where it's always one time and it just says too late.
I think something I didn't get to mention is humor in science fiction.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a whole separate subject.
Oh, sure.
It needs a lecture of its own.
Yeah.
Or just a chat. And people should read the books first anyway. That's
a book. An old New York cartoon that has a little clock face. And there's 12 things on 5 hands. And where the number of these is now.
Okay. Well, this was fun. I enjoyed this.
What
did
the dinner?
I hope you all enjoyed it.
I've written some science fiction first to read. I'd love to have a personally review. Do you do that?
I don't, and I'll tell you why.
Okay, so we're
I don't, because we're moving in the teacher's page. But what happens is, it has happened a few times. People will read for good parts of paper, and a few years down the line, they get sued for stealing the ideas. Would you believe that? Believe it.
She's on the
on my agency's very much. So I only read for people that I know. I'll tell you what you do.
Why don't we just
go
to
here's what you do. Go and find a podcast as he reads
science fiction.
And you ask three or four people to read for you and you instruct them. I'd like you to read this script. You're not in the story to me, you're in the readers of science fiction.
That's what you say.
I just
say,
I want to know where you start from the story, any place where you stop. Make a mark in the margin. I want to know where the story really went really well for you.
Okay.
I want to know where it did go. Where did you stop and say, I don't believe it? Where did you have a question?
What's
interrupting you again? Where's this going?
Okay.
Or, that's what is conflicting. Why did you have to turn that? You find out, let them tell
you
what the glitches are. And then you compare.
It's just
get two marks in the same place.
And then,
at least they will
change
the
rules.
Talking about the same thing with a different perspective. I have people write plus or minus next to each paragraph or check.
Absolutely.
It's entertaining or boring, that's how I...
There's another way.
You can get various levels of the crisis or the top one is looking at it, suddenly, I turned vague.
But I love story. I turn it in and it's lost, and I never want to need the editor's feedback.
You have to turn it in and I send it off to you.
Yeah, but it just the forms are bad.
Get yourself a bit blurry. Get your story worked over the
time. My car, if you want, is a good thing. Yeah,
you drive. Story
you
drive. Some feedback.
I just don't want to drive.
Tell them a little about
it.
Actually, thank you. This man runs it.
It's a writer's workshop. It's 6 weeks long. You go to it. It's here during summer. You send a couple of manuscripts to this guy right here. He reads them.
I do actually read them.
Other five
people, including myself.
That's the other thing. There's
actual science fiction writers.
Lots of times people don't really get that.
And make their choices based on that.
Broad geography.
Yeah.
We have a website, too. With all the information.
You are with us.
I did be tested.
And I just wasn't wasn't here when you met us earlier.
I've written also a telephone number.
First file.
There you go.
Are you,
no, you're not joining us.
No,
I've got two manifestations. You know, the English department, but there's a planning one of
the airport, you probably
saw
the airport. So,
yeah, this one. It's a new stock in June 14th, and it's 2 weeks
Okay.
So I'll probably see you.
I think it's
tomorrow.
It's Father's Day. Because the tetrio.